Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 243 in Populism Had Broken Out in Europe. Well, to be more accurate, in England. The episode deals with guns, Germans and steel, the petty war of 1876. But Benjamin Disraeli had just led the Conservative Party to victory in the 1874 British elections, riding on the back of jingoistic rallying calls to the imperialist masses. The big problem with higher-flying rhetoric about the glories of empire, stroke making Britain great again, is that this grated the Boers, who believed their republics were already great. No need for some pernicious jingoist rocking up and telling independent republics they needed to be best. Balancing the needs of imperial defence, economic development, support for white settlers and humane administration fell upon the shoulders of Lord Carnarvon, who we've met on numerous occasions. South Africa of 1876 was a very different place from South Africa of 1856. By 76, the Sotho, Tswana, Venda, Pedi and Amaxhosa had all managed to secure for themselves a fairly easy access to firearms. The Griqualand diamond fields ignited what could be called a small arms race on the veld. There was supposedly an arms embargo on blacks instituted by the British government for 2 decades before, but this was frequently broken. In the Cape Colony and Griqualand West Diamond Fields, the trade in firearms depended on 2 technicalities. Importers of these weapons had to deposit a bond which indicated to whom they were going to sell the guns. Because the colonies used these bonds or tariffs, probably a more accurate description, as a source of revenue, the procedure was applied, let's say, creatively. The second technicality was that Africans needed a magistrate's permit to buy guns. Because the demand for labour was so extreme, particularly in the diamond fields, this permit system was ignored by most of the miners. If black workers wanted to be paid in firearms, they were. Even before this time, the mid to late 1870s, a heavy and illegal trade in guns and ammunition had been going on. Missionaries were supplying Tswana chiefs with guns for their defence against the Boers and the encroaching traders. Both Boers and English traders were selling black people guns too, while constantly denying this and even decrying those who did. Boer government functionaries traded firearms with Tswana and Amandebele neighbours. Thus, the great increase in the number of firearms began to aggravate the political instability of Southern Africa. Tswana and other black chiefs jockeyed for position with each other as well as with the expanding Boer republics. The ivory trade in the Tswana and the near Limpopo country was especially useful to the Ngwato capital, Shoshong. In 1874, an Austrian hunter who travelled to Chief Sekoma of Ngwato estimated his annual earnings from ivory cattle, feathers and skins topped £3,000, all facilitated by guns. In 1877, the volume of ivory passing through Shoshong to the south was about 68,000 kilograms, or to put it another way, the tusks of about 12,000 elephants. By the last quarter of the 19th century, most of the Tswana groups around the Transvaal had firearms of various kinds, but they were literally killing the goose that laid the golden ivory. The ivory trade was going to end by the early 1900s because the pachyderms were shot to extinction in most areas. During the 1870s, when Griqualand West was a kind of mini-colony annexed by the British, the trade in the munitions of war between white merchants and Africans reached staggering proportions. During the last few months of 1873, for example, over 18,000 guns were imported into Griqualand West. By now, most of the African buyers knew an outdated weapon when they saw one, and this meant that many of the guns being bought were the latest models. By the time of the next frontier war in 1877, the Amaxhosa were going to be firing on the British with the same make and model they themselves were being fired on by the British. The Basutu Gun War was going to break out around the same time, and again the British officers involved would complain about the Basutu were using modern weapons. When both sides are armed with the same weapon, they can use each other's ammunition. So the winter of 1876 settled hard across the Transvaal. At night, the frost lay white along the banks of the Steelpoort River, cattle breath rising like smoke in the early dawn. By the mid-morning, of course, the sun was sharp. The air brittle and the mountains to the east seemed to shimmer in their haze. Shimmering today are the minerals mined there, chrome, platinum, vanadium. These are the Leolo Mountains, bastion in those days of the petty king under King Sekukuni I. Across the valleys, his people had built stone-walled settlements ringed with thorn stockades, their cattle kraals protected by rifle pits dug into the hillsides. To the south, in Pretoria, President Thomas François Burgers prepared his republic for war. He was no soldier, trained instead in theology, prone to long speeches, dressed in somber black. But he was determined to show that the Transvaal could still assert itself after years of debt, political squabbling, and military vacillation. On the 16th of May, 1876, the Volksraad declared war on Sekukuni. The long simmering contest between the Pedi and the Boer Republic was about to reach a climax. The Pedi kingdom was no stranger to conflict. Under Sekwati, Sekukuni's father, they had fought off repeated attacks during the mid-19th century. Their stone fortresses had turned back Boer commandos in the 1840s and the 50s. Sekwati had once been besieged in Thabo Maseka, surviving by ingenuity, patience, and the determination of his people. By the 1860s, as the Boers pushed further east and north, the Pedi adapted quickly. They entered trade networks stretching to Delagoa Bay, securing muskets and ammunition. They also expanded diplomatically, incorporating neighbouring groups through alliance and conquest. When Sekukuni rose to power in 1861, he inherited both his father's enemies and his strategies. He strengthened fortifications, he built alliances, and expanded the kingdom's reach. By the mid-1870s, the Pedi stood as one of the strongest African polities in the region. For the Transvaalers, that was a standing challenge, an African power on its doorstep that could not be ignored. Burger's decision to take the field personally in 1876 was unusual. Most Boer presidents had preferred to leave command to military leaders, but Burgers, faced with wavering loyalty amongst his people, believed his own presence would inspire confidence. So he set out from Pretoria in June, a curious sight, the President of the Republic riding in a carriage at the head of a commando, not exactly a virile commander on his horse then. His arrival in the frontier zones caused mixed reactions. Some Burgers mocked him as unfit for the rigors of war. Others were reassured, though, that their leader would share their risks. The force that gathered at the Steelpoort River was a mixture of reluctant Burgers, hired auxiliaries, and artillerymen. Among their assets were Krupp 7-pounders, gleaming with new steel, which Burgers believed would smash Pedi defences. What he did not fully appreciate was the terrain ahead, nor the resilience of a kingdom that had already faced decades of assault. The first major action in the war came at Matebe's mountain. Rising sharply above the surrounding veld, it had become a fortified redoubt. Burgers himself nicknamed it the Black Gibraltar. On the 4th and 5th July 1876, Boer commandos, backed by Swazi allies, attacked the stronghold. The fighting was fierce. The Pedi defenders fell back under sustained fire, and after 2 days of struggle, the Boers captured the position. From the summit, Burgers could see across the valleys towards the Leolo Ranges. He declared the victory a sign that God's hand was with the Republic. Reports carried back to Pretoria told of Pedi surrendering and seeking peace. For a moment, it seemed the war might end quickly. But Matebe was not the heart of the Pedi kingdom. It was an outpost. The true test lay deeper in the mountains. Just a few weeks later came the episode that etched itself into Pedi memory. Johannes Dinkwanyani, half-brother of Sekukuni, led his people at the settlement of Mafolofolo. They were Christians, linked to missionary networks, yet fiercely loyal to Pedi sovereignty. In mid-July, Swazi forces allied to the Boers descended on Mafolofolo. The defenders fought desperately. After 2 days of fighting, Johannes was gravely wounded and died 3 days later. Oral history records his last words as, "Fight on to defend Mafolofolo and never abandon your Christian faith." Thus Mafolofolo fell, yet its story travelled across the Pedi kingdom, binding faith and resistance in a single narrative. Burgers pressed on, hoping to capitalise on the momentum. On the 1st of August, his column approached another Pedi stronghold. The following day, 2nd of August, the commanders attempted an assault. This time the Pedi were ready. Hidden rifle pits poured fire into the attackers. The slopes were alive with defenders who knew every gully and boulder. Confusion spread among the burghers. Some began to retreat. Others simply fled. By nightfall, the campaign was effectively over. The Boers had been repulsed. Around the campfires that evening, burghers muttered the phrase that would enter the record. Die heiste oorlog. The go-home war. The humiliation was profound. The President of the Republic had led his army into the mountains, only to be driven back in disarray. Burghers tried to salvage dignity by establishing Fort Kruger Pos near the Steelpoort River. The fort was little more than a rough earthwork with a few stone walls, but it served as a symbolic anchor. He hoped it would reassure burghers that something had been gained. In reality, morale was shattered. Many men deserted. Others openly criticized the president. Letters home spoke of exhaustion, disease, and despair. The Pedi, meanwhile, consolidated their defences. Sekhukhune had survived the assault intact. By late August, the war had collapsed into stalemate. President Berger's grand promise of quick victory had evaporated among the ridges of the Iliolo Mountains. The commando had withdrawn. Fort Kruger Pos was thrown up in haste, and Berger's grumbled about lost time and wasted cattle. The Republic was broke, its men unwilling, its president mocked. It was into this void that Conrad von Schlickmann arrived. No one in the Transvaal had heard of him a year before. He styled himself Colonel, though whether his Prussian army service had been more than a junior commission is hard to say. Like many European officers of fortune, he seemed to appear suddenly on the colonial fringe, carrying a vague air of professional competence and a willingness to use it for hire. In other times, men like him had turned up in Mexico, in the Balkans, in South America. The 19th century produced a surplus of European soldiers with nowhere to fight at home. Africa, with its shifting frontiers and constant wars, offered a new stage. On the 4th of September, 1876, the Volksrat formally contracted von Schlickmann and his Ladenburg Volunteer Corps. They were promised farms in Pedi territory, 2,000 acres each, if the war succeeded. Pay was offered, but in practice it came in the form of IOUs. Everyone knew what this meant. They would make good their wages only by plundering Pedi settlements. The corps was small, a few hundred men, but better drilled than the reluctant burghers. The corps carried breech-loading rifles, drilled in European formations, and marched under their own banners. Local accounts called them the German Legion, though there were a mix of nationalities, Germans, Dutch emigres, Irish adventurers, even a handful of Englishmen. They fought differently from the commando. They believed in a scorched-earth tactic. Instead of skirmishing and withdrawing like the Boers, they descended on Pedi villages, burning huts and seizing livestock. They intimidated the enemy, and their discipline in line gave them a swagger. They cultivated fear deliberately. Reports speak of entire homesteads torched in reprisal for minor resistance. Where the burghers might have taken captives, or just leave the wounded where they lay, Schlickmann's men made examples. They cut the throats of Pedi wounded after battle, an act corroborated in the official dispatches of Sir Henry Barclay to Lord Carnarvon in December 1876. Deemed even worse, they targeted non-combatants. Women and children were not spared. Barclay's report is chillingly precise. There is no longer the slightest doubt as to the murder of the two women and the child at Steelpoort by the direct order of Schlickmann. He ordered his men to cut the throats of all the wounded. This was not ordinary Boer commando warfare. It was calculated terror carried out by men who expected payment in land and loot. What von Schlickmann's corps practiced in 1876 looks in retrospect like a template. 2 decades later, German Schutztruppe in Namibia would use the same methods, small, disciplined, European-led units backed by auxiliaries, crushing African resistance with disproportionate violence and seizing land for settlers. The difference was that in Namibia, it became state doctrine, culminating in the genocidal campaigns against the Herero and Nama from 1904. In the Transvaal of 1876, it was still improvised, a desperate republic outsourcing its war to a hired bandit. But the echoes are unmistakable, the mixture of military modernity and frontier brutality, the targeting of civilians to break resistance, the link between service and promised land. Beyond Africa, Schlickmann's career also fits into a global pattern. This was the age of the freebooters, Garibaldian veterans shipped out to South America. Irish and American adventurers joined insurrections from Cuba to the Balkans. British ex-officers drifted into the Zulu Kingdom or the Diamond Fields. They carried their rifles and a sense that the world's peripheries were their hunting ground. Where had Schlickmann come from? The record is fragmentary. He is described as Prussian, sometimes with the prefix von, suggesting a minor noble. No reliable detail survives of his early career, though it is likely he had at least some training in the Prussian army, given the reputation of that officer corps in the mid-19th century. He may have served in the wars of German unification in the 1860s against Denmark or Austria, or even in 1870 against France. What is certain is that by 1876 he had made his way to the Transvaal, at the very moment when burghers needed precisely his kind of offer. At first, his corps gave the Boers a shot of confidence. Their drilling and fire discipline contrasted with their half-hearted commander. But the brutality soon caused unease amongst the Boers. They wanted to live in this region, their descendants too. Schlickmann didn't care about long-term relationships between petty and Boer. He just wanted a quick fix. Burghers, who had fought the petty for years without stooping to wholesale executions, began to mutter. Some wanted nothing to do with men who slaughtered women and children. Burghers had blundered in more than one way. His own men were now critical. It was the international effect, though, that was going to be disastrous. Barclay's dispatch carried the weight of an official British testimony. When the Colonial Office received word that the ZAR hired troops had committed atrocities, it added to the growing dossier of Republican incompetence and cruelty. In a true historical account of karma, Schlickmann himself did not last too long. In November 1876, while leading a patrol, he was ambushed by the petty and killed. Accounts suggest he died suddenly, leaving his corps leaderless. His successor was going to insult the Boers with his grandiose brigadagio. Command fell, you see, to Alfred Aylward, an Irish Fenian exile with a talent for rhetoric. Aylward had already been a political agitator in Natal, and now he seized on the war as both adventure and platform. Under him, the corps lurched into further disorder. He later published a book called The Transvaal of Today in 1878, in which he excoriated the Boer leadership, painting himself as a truth-teller and described the chaos of the campaign. Aylward's account is deeply biased, but it gives historians one of the fullest contemporary descriptions of the mercenary episode. He boasted of their discipline. He sneered at Boer cowardice and implied that only men like himself could have brought the petty to heel. In the end, though, the mercenary phase accomplished little militarily. Petty strongholds were not broken. Sekukuni remained undefeated. But politically, the damage was enormous. The Transvaal had revealed itself to be incapable of managing its own wars. It had imported violence that shocked even an empire inured to frontier brutality, and it had put itself into debt it could not pay. For the petty, the mercenaries were another threat weathered. For Britain, they were one more proof that annexation of the Transvaal was necessary. For later historians, they are a glimpse of a coming age where a small, disciplined, European-led force would attempt to remake Africa by fire, rifle, and the promise of land. By December, the Ladenburg Volunteer Corps was disintegrating. Its leader lay dead. Its successor was writing pamphlets. Its IOUs were worthless. On the ground, the petty remained in their mountains, scarred but unbroken. The mercenary experiment lasted 3 months, yet its shadows stretched forward into British annexation, into the wider story of colonial warfare, and into the memory of the petty people, who had seen outsiders arrive with strange accents, merciless methods, only to vanish again, leaving ruin in their wake. By early December 1876, the fighting on the Steel Poort had ceased to look like a war and more like a stain. What had filtered to Cape Town as rumour hardened into paperwork. Sir Henry Barclay, the governor at the Cape, collated letters and corroborating stories, and he began to comment, choosing his words carefully. Yet more than hearsay, his sources included a volunteer attached to Schlickmann, who described in cold detail women shot down and prisoners cut by the throat. Barclay had written a blunt letter to burghers on the legal question Pretoria was trying to elude whether Sekukuni owed allegiance to the ZAR at all. Barclay's conclusion was terse, as he wrote in a formal letter to prison burghers on the 28th November 1876. On the whole, it seems perfectly clear that Sir Cucuni was neither de jure or de facto a subject of the Republic when Your Honour declared war against him in June last. The two threads of a crime report and a juridical rebuke were going to be woven together by the men of the Colonial Office. In early 1877, the papers were gathered into the familiar blue-backed volumes of the Parliamentary Papers, and you can find them if you Google. They're entitled Correspondence Respecting the Transvaal Territory, and the companion volume is entitled Correspondence Respecting the War Between the Transvaal Republic and Neighbouring Native Tribes. They read like an anatomy of misrule, stall commandos, IOU paid mercenaries, civilians murdered, and a president retreating to a hastily built fort on the Steelport. For Carnarvon, all of this was a strategic windfall. He already wanted a South African Confederation, and this armed his policy with evidence. According to reports, the ZAR had declared an unlawful war, then outsourced it to irregulars who committed documented atrocities. Financially, the Republic was insolvent. Strategically, a failing Transvaal risked dragging the Cape and Natal into a wider native war. When annexation was debated in Westminster later that year, supporters could point to the paper trail and say, "This is not conjecture, it's in the dispatches." On the 24th of July, 1877, there was a debate in the British House of Commons where members argued that both a large majority of the whites and the vast majority of Africans were favourable to annexation. This was hyperbole of the highest order. It was true. Some Africans were in favour, just to keep the Boers away from their villages, but the Transvaal Boers were definitely not in favour. The petty war opened the can of worms in three ways, each of them legible in those blue books. First, it exposed Pretoria's loss of control, military, fiscal and moral, forcing burghers to hire men like Schlickman. Second, it produced quotable proof that the ZAR's war conduct had crossed a line London could not defend. And third, it gave Confederation its pretext, the argument that only imperial supervision could prevent a native war of unexampled magnitude on the northern border. Down south, in the Natal capital of Pietermaritzburg, Theophilus Shepstone was preparing to leap upon his horse and to take a ride to Pretoria, backed up by a tiny platoon of 25 men. One of the puny platooners was H. Rider Haggard, the future Victorian pop fiction author, had arrived in Natal a year earlier to take up as Natal Governor Sir Henry Bulwer's secretary. In 1876, Haggard was transferred to Shepstone's staff. It was Haggard who'd raise the Union Jack and read out the proclamation of the British annexation of the Transvaal in Pretoria a few months hence. Haggard, author of adventure fiction romances set in exotic locations, was going to raise the Union Jack. And with that intriguing note, it's time to end. Next episode, we'll canter up the hill from Maritzburg to Pretoria just in time for Haggard's halyard and to learn what the Transvaal Boers were going to do after the annexation story got around. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. Head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load updates about these episodes. You can email me from there and sign up for a newsletter. Until next, goodbye. Thank you.